arrives, quite loudly breaking into a restaurant where, it turns out, was stashed a ridiculous amount of cash, about 20,000 bucks, I seem to recall. The robbers made off with the dough, and the police were notified thanks to an alarm system and a more alert neighbor than we pipe dwellers. The police had arrived to investigate what must have been, at least partially, an inside job, and as they were scanning the surrounding area for evidence, suddenly there were three young men in eyeliner fleeing in panic. Understandably, it seemed pretty obvious to them that we must be somehow attached to the caper, although we pointed out that if we were involved, it would have been pretty stupid to lurk about the scene of the crime once the money had been properly purloined. Right, guys? We all had a pretty good laugh by the time the ordeal had passed. We were released the next morning, after a nerve-wracking night in the Huskow, just as the sun was coming up. Walking onto the front lawn of the police station, we laughed with relief that our freedom had survived the tests of the previous night. Comparing critiques of the prisoner's bathroom, Lyne and I were suddenly horrified to see Tatro reach into his crotch and produce his one-hitter box. He said, with the most righteous of indignation, "I just got this fucking thing yesterday. It was 45 bucks. I'm not about to toss it into the boneyard." Once I finished up the warm and free release of urine into my own jeans, and it seemed clear that no one was going to sound an alarm or unceremoniously tackle us onto the pavement, we each fired up a hit, exhaled, and felt the warming sunlight on our young, relieved faces. We set off on foot to face the day and get a nap before the show that night. We had been, and we remained, men of the theater. The moral of this story? Clearly, when the popo give you a hassle, stand your ground and talk to them. Don't run. Just be cool. One minor detail that may have further colored my character in the eyes of the officers that night, adding to our collective suspiciousness, was the fact that I had a record. That's right, a rap sheet. The Boneyard bust was not, in fact, my first dalliance with the Urbana Sheriff's Department. Let's rewind the tape to the previous autumn. Rewind the tape is what we said in my youth when audiovisual content was recorded on media tape, wound or rolled around reels in an actual cassette. It's fucking crazy, kids, like wiping your ass with a corn cob. Anyway, the previous autumn, so 1989. As a sophomore in the Theater Acting Conservatory at the University of Illinois, I was newly eligible to be cast in feature productions, also known as Fresh Meat. The department produced 2 main stage and 2 studio plays per semester, for which the entire body of eligible actors, 50 or 60 strong, would audition at the beginning of each semester. Each auditioning actor would perform 2 contrasting monologues for all 4 play directors at once. The directors would then hold callbacks, and the actors they liked for each role would come back and read specific material, often with other actors, to get a look at chemistry and physical size matchups and what have you. Then the directors would go behind closed doors and engage in a sweaty round of horse trading, motherfucking, and mollycoddling to try to land the best actors in their own shows. According to apocryphal student legend, a staggering quantity of oral and manual pleasuring was exchanged between faculty in these negotiations. For example, rumor had it that scoring Michael Shapiro as your Jaques or your Sky Masterson cost 2 rim jobs and a finger blast. He really was much sought after. It was his sublimely wry enunciation more than anything. Finally, a 4-show casting list would be posted on the hallway bulletin board with everyone's casting assignment for that half year. Again, youngsters, public announcements used to be made using paper hung in 1 physical location. Hilarious, right? You had to walk to the location to see the news. Further, can you imagine the drama that unfurled at this posting? Children and young adults, having dedicated their lives to embodying the tender renderings of history's most sensitive playwrights, publicly witnessing the joyful tidings of a whole semester's work, or else the devastating lack thereof. Oh, there was wailing. Oh, boy, there were tears. There was indeed gnashing of teeth. P.S., if you think you might end up gnashing your teeth in public, send a friend to read the casting and bring you the news in private. Looking at you, Greenberg. Yes, there also leapt jubilation, and at times deafening caterwauls of sheer elation shook the building to its roots. But the real show was in the disappointments. For many young hopefuls, having chosen an admittedly dicey program of study to begin with in regards to future chances of financial stability, on Mom and Dad's dime, no less, the casting sheet could spell the doom of their entire life's dream. If the theater department didn't see you as a Juliet or Lady Capulet or even a lady-in-waiting, then the Actors Theater of Louisville was goddamned unlikely to think so either, let alone Chicago. God damn it, honey. We tried it your way. We got you the colored contacts. We got you the LeBaron convertible. You won raves as 80 Annie at Glenbard South, and rightly so. You really were just magical. You really were. And I know everyone says you look like a young Julie from the Love Boat, and you do. You could be your sister. Your mother and I bought into it, too. It was intoxicating. I mean, we were all three of us giddy with delight at your prospects. We were drunk is what we were, on your talent. But you didn't get cast in Romeo and Juliet, in Champagne Urbana. Nor did you get cast in Three Sisters, or The House of Blue Leaves, or Kabuki Achilles, whatever the hell that is. 47 actors got parts. You did not, Monica. So now you will, by God, get a degree in poli-sci like we always thought you should in the first place. You get the idea. I myself was very much a newborn baby in acting school, which is to say that I was not very good at acting, which really is to say I was bad at acting at this point in my training. So, as this was my own first time through the ringer, I didn't have high hopes to begin with. I did dream that I might just have a crack at the leading man role in William Inge's American classic Picnic, just because there weren't a lot of manly types in the department. William Holden plays Hal in the movie version, a rough-and-tumble drifter in jeans and no shirt. Mumble, brood, mumble, smoke, flex, spit, kiss the girl. Right up my alley. We got into the callbacks, and lo and behold, the director had the same idea, so suddenly I was reading opposite lovely ladies in scenes for Hal and Madge. Everything was cool. A little too cool, it turns out. For right about then, this new grad student showed up, a man named David. Nice fella. His main focus had been the ballet, a fact, but now he was leaning toward theater. He was hairless, he was slightly effeminate, and he was ripped. He was sweet as pie, the kind of guy who would never upset you unless he was cast instead of you to portray a virile, swaggering cowboy. As we continued to pair off in the callback scenes, the director eventually had David try one with his shirt off. And I knew immediately that it was over. The director turned out to be the sort of chap who didn't necessarily cast the best actor for the part based on ability. He cast the best actor for the part based on tits. There are, sadly, astonishingly, too many directors in this world who operate similarly. But such is life. Hey, tits are nice. I get it. If I had succeeded in my life thanks to my sweet tits, I imagine I'd be singing a different tune. I'm certain that we've all suffered defeat at one time or another at the hands of a lesser foe who just happened to be brandishing better tits. David was a fine actor, certainly my better in that regard, but he was simply miscast as a manly person in jeans and cowboy boots. In any case, I was barely given time to foment my sour grapes, because unfortunately, there is more to the story. You see, this director also liked the cut of my particular jib, despite my medium tits, so he turned right around and started reading me in the scenes for Alan. Who is Alan, you ask? Oh, just the milquetoast college boy who is publicly emasculated when Hal poaches his girlfriend Madge, and she chooses to acquiesce to her animal desires, succumbing to Hal even though he has trouble written all over him. For Hal is a man, my friends, and Alan is merely a boy. A cuckolded boy, no less. Alan the boy even has a crying scene, downstage center, lamenting the loss of his gal to this bohunk. So, now, not only am I pissed that David the Dancer is going to handily unman me by playing Hal, but all the bookish, boyish actors who thought they had Alan sewn up are damning my eyes. Fortune presents gifts not according to the book, friends. A lesson I have learned too many times to mention. The casting was over. The list was mounted upon the hallway board. I was to play Alan. Very well. I put my shoulder to the wheel and tried as hard as I could to accomplish some semblance of good scene work. Boy, howdy, did I try. I never came close that fall, or for a few years beyond it, because what I had to ultimately learn was that I needed to be trying less. I'll save the rest for my acting technique book. Coming This Never, from E.P. Dutton, an imprint of Penguin Random House. The important thing was that I tried my best, and I never gave up. And I could even discern that, although I had a lot farther to go in my journey, the audience at least understood the words I was speaking. I've always taken my small victories wherever I could find them. Now I'm 43, and I am happy to report that I still have even a lot farther to go. But goddamn, folks, I'm a good sight better now than I was during that picnic autumn. Anyway, we were talking about crime. Joe Faust was a year older than me, and he was also more mature in some very practical ways, which I admired. He was not so mature, however, that he wouldn't join me in our favorite running joke, shoplifting stupid items. It was hilarious. We'd try to outdo each other, with an item's uselessness being the key value for scoring points toward an intangible victory. A box of panty liners, granny glasses, a book of Bible verses for dealing with fatal diseases. Hilarious, right? Being 19 was amazing. I was an unstoppable pilferer. We would exit the chosen establishment, barely containing our mirth until we could pull out whatever dumb trinket we had just heisted. Then we would laugh. Oh, how we would double over and cackle in the glow of the parking lot lights. What could be more fun than pointless petty larceny? Fracking, maybe? One day, we went to the Kmart so Joe could purchase a microwave for his girlfriend for Christmas. I wandered innocuously about while he selected his oven and paid. Then, as we sauntered out, the security man said, "Excuse me, can I please talk to you?" "Oh, yeah," I replied, thoroughly amazed that they had somehow detected my thievery. He asked to examine the front of my jeans, and sure enough, there he found not four, not five, not even six, but 8 Ronnie Millsap cassettes. 8 Ronnie Millsap cassettes. Please hit pause on your player to calm your exploding heart rate. All good? To resume. 8 Ronnie Millsap cassettes. 8 disparate Ronnie Millsap albums on cassette. You have to admit that was an amazing haul in terms of scoring points in our game. I had apparently shoved him into the front of my jeans, standing directly in front of a two-way mirrored security window. The man took me back to his office to show me where he had been sitting whilst watching me commit my smooth misdemeanor. His chair behind the mirror was about 14 feet from the display of country greats on sale. I said that I felt pretty stupid and that it was actually just a hilarious joke and that I wasn't actually even familiar with Mr. Millsap's stylings. He told me that if I could pay for the tapes right then, he'd let me go. I remember the total being about $17 and change. I did not have it. He said he was sorry, but he'd have to call the police in then. I stoically said, "Well, that's your call, but I fucking won, bro." So, puzzled at my bravado, he did. That Kmart bastard had the rectitude to call the fucking cops. Imagine hearing my end of that call. "Hey, Dale, it's Cleve." "Heh, it's hanging." "I got one for you." "Nah, white boy." "You ready?" 8 Ronnie Millsap tapes. "Ronnie Millsap." 8. "Nope, 8. He says it's hilarious." "All right, see ya." It suddenly dawned on me that this might not be so great, because in about 5 hours I was supposed to appear in the opening night performance of Picnic. Oh my good Jesus. A deputy came from the sheriff's office and arrested me and cuffed me and walked me out of the store in front of all the mothers pulling their children in close to them, and my friend Joe, who quickly communicated that he didn't think the Ronnie Millsap tapes were really that funny in this instance. He was just pissed because I had driven us there in my Subaru Brat, and he couldn't drive a stick, so he was stranded. In an attempt to further diminish my ultimate victory, he pointed out that he had written a check, with our address on it, for the microwave, so it wasn't really the ideal setup for lifting humorously useless objects. As he spoke, all I heard was, "You are the ultimate champion forever of our awesome game." The deputy said something like, "Okay, let's move along. Now gird yourself, we're about to pass some Engelbert Humperdinck cassettes." Then he shoved me past the candy bars and out the door. The whole pageant was meant to cow and shame me, and it worked, like a charm. It was an intense wake-up call to suddenly be handcuffed in the back of a police car, heading downtown at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. My life as I knew it was about to come to a screeching halt, for this was the worst possible night I could have chosen to be unwillingly detained by the law. Visions of Sean Penn and Isai Morales from Bad Boys, the 1983 film, filled my mind's eye, and I expected, upon arriving up the river, to soon find myself garnished with the hocked-up loogies of my new, jeering fellow inmates. I was taken into the station and booked straight up. The sheriff's deputies told me that, due to my tender years, they would go pretty easy on me. I'd be released that day if I posted bail, then I'd have to return to a sort of lightweight court for sentencing, which would probably be a fine or community service. I started to think that I might just find my way clear of this bed I had just shat. Suck on that, Isai Morales. By the way, I've always been such a fan of his that I used to dream of growing up to be called the White Isai Morales. Shortly after I arrived in the Urbana joint, my friend Goliath, alerted by Joe Faust, showed up with my bail, which I think was about $250. Good man. Seems I was all set to get off easy. And it was here, right at this goddamn point, that I made my second biggest mistake of the afternoon. It was in the words that I spoke aloud to the fine officers processing me. "Gentlemen, I want to say to you that I am truly sorry that I committed this grave error this afternoon, and I can assure you that I am and will remain sincerely repentant. I am a jackass of the first order. This is now clear to me. Jack-ass totally. I mean, wow, guys, officers, I have learned a lesson here. A lesson and a half has been learned. And now, if you wouldn't mind, hustling my paperwork along, expediting it, as they say, for you see, I am a student of the theater, and tonight is actually the opening night of my play, Picnic, on the main stage over at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, so it's pretty much a big deal, and it's my first show ever, because I'm a sophomore, and they have a whole hierarchy pecking order kind of thing, where they post the casting on the board. So anyway, my call time is 6:30 for an 8 p.m. show. It's 5 o'clock now, so thanks for the hustle. The officers kindly looked at one another and said to me, "Opening night? You don't say. That sounds important, all right. Don't you worry, buddy. We'll take care of it. We love the arts around here." Amazing. I sighed my relief all over them. I made my gratitude very clear to the deputies, and I don't believe I cried. I flashed back to my Grandpa Ray telling me years earlier, "You made your bed, now you have to sleep in it." I briefly hated that beloved man, now gone, for the painfully appropriate timbre of his aphorism. How close had I just come to bringing the curtain of justice down upon the closing night of my whole shebang? This was seriously, seriously bad. Missing the show for such a delinquent reason would certainly see me expelled from school, and so I would not have blamed myself for crying, but I believe I kept it together. I'm one hell of an optimist, is all it is. Such a sunny disposition can make a body powerfully stupid some of the time, but it's mostly worked out for me so far. Blissful ignorance, I believe, is the operative phrase. The officers had put me relatively at ease, and then they put me in the holding cell right there across from them. I could see them through a large window, but I couldn't hear. 5:30 p.m. 6 p.m. Everyone seemed pretty calm. Immobile, really. Hold up. I didn't need to hear. My eyes were all the equipment I required to deduce that the men wearing the uniforms had not lifted a finger since putting me in the cell. The clock was ticking. 6:15. Oh, my Lord. What? Fucking what now? The bail had been posted. Goliath was waiting to drive me to the theater, a mere 15-minute trip or less, and all that remained was for these sons of bitches to punch my ticket and show me the door. 6:30. Holy Jesus and Mary and Joseph. My misstep dawned on me slowly as I watched the two deputies look innocently at each other with the very slightest of smirks, then continue reading the newspaper. Feet up on the desk, the whole bit. Holy shit. 7 o'clock. Motherfuck. Finally, the penny dropped. I cottoned to my precise dilemma just before I banged on the window to communicate that I was indeed shitting little green apples in there. I saw their game. I comprehended the bit, and so I waited. They were fucking with me. They wanted the idiot in the headband, the one with the Ronnie Millsap tapes. Oh, fuck, what if they were huge Millsap fans? And the opening night to at least sweat a little bit, right? What a dipshit I must have sounded to them. What a dipshit I was, in fact. I most certainly obliged them, as I did readily sweat some bullets and also some Brazil nuts and a few lumps of rock salt as well. My time in the joint, my stint, had run up to literally dozens of minutes by now, plenty of time to think about where I'd go from here, a hardened criminal with a record. I suppose I'd go back to framing houses in Manuka, my hometown. My sweet parents would be so disappointed in me, the most decent people I had ever come across, about to be handed back this steaming pile of a son. It was 7:38 when the fuzz finally roused themselves to emancipate your pudding-headed author. Man, they thought they were pretty goddamn funny. I did not have time to join them in their mirth, however. Goliath violated some speed limits, flagrantly, on the way down Green Street to the stage door of the theater, and I sprinted into the dressing room with about 7 or 8 minutes to get it together. Slapped on some makeup and threw on my loafers and yellow cardigan. Alan, remember? Our assistant director, Mike Siegel, a friend, had gotten wind of my predicament and covered for me with some little white fabrication or other, and before I knew it, I was clumsily blubbering through my crying scene in Act Two. Most definitely the best crying scene I've ever delivered. I was saved. Did I mention that I got lucky every now and again? The final chapter saw me called in front of a court of kindly and august senior citizens, who I dare say saw me for what I was, a harmless dumbass. When one sweet grandmother complimented my work in Picnic, I knew I was sitting pretty. After sincerely communicating to them that I had learned my lesson, I was gratified to hear that my sentence would consist of a mere 100 hours of community service. I was shown a list of departments to choose from, and I went with animal control. Easy. Did anybody ever choose sanitation? With no exaggeration whatsoever, I can report that I spent some weekends helping sorority girls look at puppies at the Humane Society. It was not too hard to swallow, to be honest. Confirming my absolute reputation as an asswipe, I didn't even show up for the entirety of the 100 hours, and I never did hear from anybody about it. Yes, you are correct. I was a douche. Now, friends, what can we take away from this cautionary tale? I do think it's important to behave rebelliously when leaving the nest and striking out on one's own, but I would suggest coming up just short of breaking the law. If you are going to burglarize a retail establishment, for Christ's sake, case the joint ahead of time. Also, don't ever underestimate the value of Ronnie Millsap. Be smart while getting stupid. When the work is done, then we deserve to play. After 10 sweaty hours in the wood shop, when I'm covered in sawdust, that first Corona tastes like the jizz of the Lord. Which has to be the most magnificent beverage, right? The libation of glory. And in my life, one of my greatest leisure time pleasures has been smoking a bong in the living room before settling down with the new episode of Twin Peaks, or maybe a Jim Jarmusch film. Dead Man? Heaven. Or some animation or claymation. Akira? Wallace and Gromit? Sublime. Therefore, if I had to choose one god to serve, I would choose Dionysus, the Greek god of wine, song, and theater. My Eucharist is found in entertaining people, receiving the bread and wine of laughter and tears from the crowd, and being brought to catharsis by the work of others. When I take the stage, Dionysus, or Bacchus, sees and hears my ministry, and he is muchly pleased. Or she. No reason to stick to the tired dogma of the patriarchy. I like to engage in revelry. I like to celebrate the human experience through performance. I like to engender mirth. I like to abide pleasure with my body, and one way that we funny monkeys have learned to know delight is through the consumption of intoxicants. All splendid treats in the proper dosage, but just like religion, the opiate of the masses, you can use them responsibly and do good, or you can use them like an asshole and ruin it for the rest of us who just want to get a little high and look at a maple leaf. Let's have a look at our choices, shall we? Number 1. Wine and beer. The workhorses. You keep these expendables in stock, like paper towels and salt. And just like salt, you will enjoy them throughout your life as long as you don't overdo it. Beer, in all its infinite varieties these days, is obviously one of the staples of life. For a pint of beer, you can never beat Guinness or Old Rasputin. In the life of the theater professional, 3 pints a night in the local public house is simply a part of one's workday, and it's nice work if you can get it. My leisure time was dominated by beer throughout my youth and into my 20s because wine just didn't have much of a foothold in my part of the Midwest. Aunt Dee would drink white wine, but then she always was a bit fancy. I never understood what all the fuss was about until my wife bought a really nice bottle of Cabernet Sauvignon on New Year's Eve 2000. We were at a beautiful cabin in Santa Barbara, and we counted down the last hours of our first 8 months together as we sipped this red wine that made my head and body feel like delicious candy. I'm not talking about shitty candy, which also has its place of honor, your Skittles, your Willy Wonka varietals, your Paydays. No, I'm talking about handmade, rich people candy. This wine? Fermented grape juice, mind you. Tasted and felt like Edmund's description of Turkish delight in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And buddy, I signed up as, and I remain, a card-carrying member of the Wine Enthusiasts Club. For lo, it is some good shit. Number 2. whiskey, and the lesser spirits. Try to utilize the hard liquors with less frequency than you do beer. Did I spend a period of my youth chugging Jim Beam? Sure I did, as it provided a swift and complete oblivion, which is sometimes what we're looking for in life. That was a thankfully brief stint when I was despairing of ever finding a lady who could stand me and one whom I could tolerate in return. Once I got my head on straight, I learned that bourbons exist to rival even the qualities of Jim Beam. Furthermore, I discovered Irish and Scotch whiskies, to which I remain devoted. For a single malt Scotch, Lagavulin will never disappoint. It's practically furry. I'll be happy to further enumerate the admirable qualities of whiskey consumption over a glass of the good stuff should you ever catch me out at the bar. Number 3. Nitrous oxide. N2O, laughing gas, or whippets? Ah, old friend. Not just at the dentist anymore. For those of you who have deprived yourselves of this brief delight, please hustle out to the store and pick up several cans of ready-to-squirt whipped cream and let the fun begin. The cream remains in the can, fully wasted, as the propellant nitrous oxide enters your lungs and thereby your circulatory system. You will experience a lightheaded euphoria, as well as auditory hallucinations, culminating in smiles of glee or laughter. If you want to consume this goodness without wasting all that yummy dairy product, go to the gourmet store and purchase a case or three of N2O cartridges and a whipped cream charger. Or buy a little twist cracker at your local head shop and empty your cartridge into a pretty balloon. Load up a hit, put on Echolalia by Dead Can Dance, and drink deep, chum. Find a nice place to recline and listen to any good noises, a freight train, a subway, a waterfall, a Wilco show. Just sit where the popo won't be hassling you. Good, clean fun. I've seen friends fall down and go boom whilst using this stuff, so maybe keep your seat. Number 4. Weed. Sweet, sweet lady. Marijuana is quite possibly the finest of intoxicants. It has been scientifically proven for decades to be much less harmful to the body than alcohol when used on a regular basis. If you don't believe me, Google science. I applaud and support all of the legalization efforts perpetually underway in our country, but I kind of doubt it's going to make it all the way through the federal legal system until Big Tobacco wakes up and gets behind it. I'm calling you out, RJ. Step right up to your face and diss you, Philly Morris. You continue to cling to the legality of your carcinogenic smoking product that has been outlawed in most public spaces in America, but do you not see the potential in Marlboro Green? Own it! Regulate it! Tobacco will be going away, you know it. You have seen that writing on the wall. Turn that acreage over to cannabis, my brothers. People are constantly committing crimes whilst under the influence of, or looking for funding for, every other intoxicant besides marijuana. I am a super sweet teddy bear, but when I drink tequila, I want to knife somebody. When a person injects heroin, I've read, they want to lie in bed and drool with pleasure, listening to Coltrane's Giant Steps until the fix wears off, then they want to go out and threaten to knife somebody to get money for more heroin so they can get back to drooling on their pillow. When I smoke pot, I want to look at nature and laugh about everything and eat some delicious things and then sleep. For Willie's sake, do the math. Number 5. Mushrooms. Yes, indeed. The gentle brother of the hallucinogen family. All the giggles and visuals without the chemical jaw grinding and speedy after effects of Big Brother LSD. I remember one beautiful day in the woods of Allerton Park near Monticello, Illinois, tripping on shrooms with my brother, Falcon Smoker. Looking at leaves and trees, swimming in the river, listening to the birds and frogs and wood nymphs' song, gulping in the sweet air and glory of living, then winding down to wait out the waves of sensory bliss so we could head home. Once we were somewhat straightened out, we set off for home, blasting Ennio Morricone's magnificent soundtrack to The Mission, particularly track 12, called River. And in the early dark on the highway, all the other taillights looked like X-Wing fighters, which lent a comforting perception of nostalgia to the ride. Treat your intoxicants with respect, and they will do right by you. Number 6. Amyl nitrate or poppers? Not worth it. Small head rush, massive brain cell carnage, often followed by a splitting headache. Might as well huff glue. Number 7. Glue. I've tried some and gotten the most profound effects from that crazy blue PVC plumbing adhesive, but it's a very low-grade high. Your head feels dirty inside, probably from all the poison from the glue. Pass. Huffing vapors is the intoxicant of true desperation. Number 8. Chicharrones, cracklins, or pork rinds. Not technically an intoxicant, but you could never tell me that. My buddy Pat Roberts and I were hooked on those bubbly, crunchy skin chips, and we had it bad. The great thing about this snack food is that it's mostly protein and therefore much healthier than most of the garbage Frito-Lay is churning out. No offense, Frito-Lay. I love a bag of Doritos as much as the next Midwesterner, but I've read all of Michael Pollan's books, so let's just call it like it is. To place my pork skin problem chronologically, let's just say it went real nice with Jim Beam and Virginia Blister peanuts for dessert. Keep the peanut can for loose hardware, and you've done your part for Mother Earth today. Chapter 9. Born Again. Again. During our last couple of years of high school, both Lynette and I worked part-time at Manuka's one video store, MixFlix. This should serve to date the business just a bit for you. The video store also had two tanning beds in the back, Cool Rays Tanning. I was 15 or 16 at the time, and my boss, Jeff, was about 22. He had a BMW, which was just insane in Manuka. He might as well have been driving around a spaceship. He was a dashing, young, entrepreneurial guy, and his folks had helped set him up with this video store, which was doing very well. Turned out people liked movies back then in 1980s Illinois. Jeff and I took a shine to each other, despite his insistence on calling me Tricky Nicky. I have found in life that the person signing the paychecks will tend to call you whatever the hell he or she pleases. A couple of other friends also worked there part-time, and the video store was, of course, in a strip mall, so we indulged in meals from the teepee hut, two doors down to the right, and sometimes we'd get beers from Manuka Liquors, one door down to the left. If we needed prophylactics or batteries or lube, we could nip next door to the right to Kodo Pharmacy. In other words, we wanted for nothing. As a responsible young chap, I was trusted to be on the receiving end of such dreamy tasks as delivering Jeff's BMW to him in Chicago and making sure that the ladies in the tanning beds had all the beverages they required. In the days when the VCR was king, you can imagine what a big to-do would be made over films like Aliens, Platoon, and yes, Three Men and a Baby. We practically had to open a new wing to accommodate all of the VHS copies and cardboard stand-ups of Tom Cruise for Top Gun. I enjoyed playing Highlander over and over on the in-house system in the hopes that the populace would come to know the pleasures of the quickening. Little did I dream then that I would one day come to reside on those shelves myself. To date, I think my most popular title in Manuka is Miss Congeniality 2, Armed and Fabulous. Cut to our first semester down at the U of I, where Lynette and I were learning that our affiliation was by this juncture ill-fated. The writing on the wall plainly read that we should part ways, but I wasn't, quite ready to give up my security blanket, by which I mean, of course, her vagina. I could hardly get to sleep at night without curling up in that cozy thicket. Reality continued to splash cold water on our situation, and Lynette finally put her foot down and sent me packing. I went into withdrawal, and although my new friends and my life in theater school made it a bit easier to go on, I just couldn't shake what turned out to be a bit of an obsession. We still spoke often, which of course helped matters very little in terms of my attempt to quit her cold turkey. Interestingly, her sister had just won 3 plane tickets to Jamaica. So Lynette, her mom, and her sister were going to go to the beach for a week. By this point, she had commenced with seeing other guys, which only sprinkled sweet gasoline on the flame I continued to fan. She told me about the Jamaica trip, and I very casually asked, "So is anyone going with you?" "No, just the ladies." "Splendid." An idea was taking shape in the steel trap of my lust-riddled noggin. A goddamn great idea. Over the course of a few conversations, I took note of the pertinent details regarding their travel arrangements. I had seen pretty much every episode of the A-Team, so I knew how to hatch a goddamn plan. I knew my MixFlix boss Jeff's sister, Kelly, worked at Midway Airport in Chicago, which was from where Lynette and company were to depart. So after 24 odd tall boys of Miller Genuine Draft had changed hands, wink, Kelly hooked me up with all the details and a standby ticket to Jamaica the day before Lynette was to arrive. I would infiltrate the perimeter, perform some recon, get the lay of the land, and then just hunker down to wait. I had once flown home from North Dakota, but this flight out of the country was major. Added to which, the whole standby thing was baffling. Then, things suddenly turned from baffling to terrifying when I got the call that my flight was oversold and I was to be bumped to the next day, to her flight. There was only one flight a day, and this was a great many years before Expedia.com, not to mention I was a total babe in the woods when it came to airplane travel. But even so, Kelly told me that I really had no choice. It was either fly on the same flight as my target, I mean the object of my affection, or bail on the plan completely. To this day, I can never tell if I'm ballsy or just stupid, but by God, I generally tend to go for it. I went to the airport armed with some items I had borrowed from the costume shop at school. Ironically, in hindsight, I glued on a full thick mustache, which was very much like my adult mustache. I dabbed some gray into my hair, which was slicked with Brill Cream, and donned aviator glasses. Additionally, I wore a fat suit of 2 towels wrapped and bound around my middle, along with some of my dad's more conservative school teacher clothes. Average middle-aged guy going to Jamaica was the look to which I aspired, with a newspaper and a small duffel bag. Ignorant of the ways of the boarding gate, I was utterly bewildered when told to stand next to the door whilst all of the ticketed passengers walked right past. I held up my newspaper real cool-like and managed not to wet my dad's brown polyesters as Lynette and her party of 3 sauntered by, laughing. Once the legit flyers were all aboard, then the standby crowd was assigned seats. So far, so good. I made my way onto the plane, and I'll be goddamned if I wasn't seated 1 seat behind her, 1 seat to the right. "Okay, okay, be cool. You got this, buddy." I could actually see the right side of her face through the gap between the seats. This was pretty goddamn hilarious so far. During the flight, Lynette got up to retrieve something from the compartment above her, and we actually nodded at each other. I thought, man, are you gonna crack up when I tell you about this later? In my head, I was absolutely living out a fantasy as the cool protagonist in my very own John Cusack super romantic comedy, when in truth I was 100% stalking this poor young dancer. Terrific. We landed in Jamaica, and having done the recon back stateside, I knew just where to go. I got in a cab and sped to the beachfront hotel where they were staying. It was all feeling pretty insane, what with the tropical climate, not to mention the big Rasta dude driving a Jeep as a cab, blaring some kick-ass UB40. I went into the hotel men's room and donned my cut-off jean shorts, which were still a pretty acceptable garment in the 80s. The moment of reckoning was drawing tantalizingly near. As I had correctly surmised, within an hour of their arrival, they were down on the beach, an incredibly long stretch of beautiful white sand, at the far end of which I sat reading, incongruously, a book of Thornton Wilder plays. Lynette was walking toward me in a bikini, thankfully with some distance between herself and her mom, who it bears mentioning had been a fan, at least up until this point. I walked up to her in my super swazy cut-off jeans and, just like I rehearsed, stated, "Hey, Lynette, how's it going?" Her jaw dropped, amazed. She was clearly feeling something powerful, like probably love, and she said, "I don't fucking believe you did this, you asshole," which means motherfucker in born-again speak. And she punched me in the chest. "I came here to get away from you. This is my vacation from all the crap I have to figure out in my life." Holy shit, I am so sorry. I meant for this to be awesome, but I have clearly just upset you. Sorry. You won't see me again. Then, as though seeing them for the first time, she took a good long look at my jean shorts. Then she took in my book of plays by Thornton Wilder. Something shifted behind her eyes and beneath her intestines. Within an hour, we were having rub sex in the shallow water on the beach. I had had a positive feeling that she would appreciate my surprise, and she did, eventually. But then, after a solid scrump and munch session, she said, "Okay, this was really nice, and now you have to leave. I seriously don't want to see you again. This is my week here. And when we get home, there's no more. For real." All right. Okay. All in all, things had gone pretty well up until this point. I wasn't trying to win her back. I think, ultimately, we were both just happy to make our final love time a memorable one. I had happily suffered a chest punch in exchange for a rich romantic coupling in the Caribbean surf. I couldn't help but clench an imaginary cigar in my teeth and utter to the B.A. Baracus in my head, "I love it when a plan comes together." Unfortunately, that was the end of the successfully orchestrated part of my plan. I had been so focused on my big say-anything moment that I hadn't given much thought to the post-coital accommodations. I mean, I was old buddies with these ladies, so I was sure they'd at least let me crash on the couch. No dice. Not knowing what to do next, with all the $70 in my pocket, I went into a payphone and called Jeff back home. "Well, Jeffrey, the eagle has landed, and the eagle has been kissed, but now the eagle is homeless and without much bread. I guess I'll fly home tomorrow. Pick me up?" "Ah, Tricky Nicky. Ha ha. You got some major brass ones, my friend. You got it. I'll see you at Midway." "Great. Now what?" I looked through the phone book and found a cheap place in the mountains. I called up, and the lady was very nice on the phone. She even sent their Jeep to pick me up. Looking back, this was probably a pretty crappy hotel, but for a 19-year-old playing hooky from Illinois, it was a crazy paradise. I was completely enamored of the colonial style, situated as it was amongst the jungle foliage. When I arrived, the manager, Maria, with whom I had spoken on the phone, was just as nice in person. There was a big shindig underway with a live reggae band and everyone was drinking daiquiris. I had never even heard of a daiquiri. Turns out, it was like strawberry rum booze, all cold and shit. Fucking right on. Ladies and gentlemen, Jamaica. I commenced to dancing with the people and feeling like life was not too bad. I was thinking even of calling Lynette because we really enjoyed dancing together and I thought she would love this music, but then again, this Maria was beginning to be ever more super nice. Long story short, I spent the night with her and she packed me off to the airport the next morning in the blue and yellow dashiki she'd been wearing. Ultimately, this caper turned out to be a really fun way to wrap up a great teenage romance. When I tell this story, people often accuse me of behaving like a stalker, and even in those pre-9/11 halcyon days of travel, my subterfuge could definitely have been interpreted as creepy. But I hope that the story's resolution makes it plain that everyone involved came out of the fray with a satisfied smile. The only downside, really, was discovering that I was allergic to something, presumably strawberry daiquiris, judging from the painful red rash all around my crotchal area. The mustache makes the magic. First of all, Teddy Roosevelt. Pow! How's that for a punch in the teeth, or mustache? As a mere sprout, mustaches always represented simply manhood to me, as well as heroes, cowboys, and my uncles Don and Dan, who were already my idols and had mustaches that were flinty, bristly, completely virile, and tough as nails. When I was just a little pisser, I knew that I would only truly become a man upon the day that I could grow a mustache. I associated the notion of these noble whiskers mostly with my uncles because they owned tractors, wore vice grip pliers on their belts, and were out in the weather harvesting their incomes by way of cultivating crops in the soil. They were brave, admirable souls to me. They still are, much like Burt Reynolds and Tom Selleck were at the time. A mustache carries with it a little bit of derring do. You're the kind of guy who'll come barreling up doing a power slide in your pickup truck and then give a girl a wink. You know your knots. You know what to do with beef tallow. Freddie Mercury was also a major idol of mine, and he had a badass mustache to perfectly complement his whole leather guy Tom of Finland thing. When I eventually learned that he was gay, I didn't think less of him, I just thought that gay people must be pretty kick-ass then if he was one of them. Before I ever knew anything about sexuality, I just thought he was a rough-slash-pretty-looking dude who could sing his face off. And once I began to learn about the varying sexual orientations of we humans, then I thought he was a rough-slash-pretty-looking dude who could sing his face off. I recently had the extreme pleasure of showing my friend Chris Pratt the seminal 1986 film Highlander, which is required viewing for young men anyway, and I was blown away yet again by the amazing Queen songs that make up the film's soundtrack. Freddie Mercury brought manhood to the stage like few before him and damn fewer since. A mustache tells folks that you're willing to take the bull by the horns. You have a certain amount of gravel in your craw, like many of Sean Connery's characters. Name me one actor since Connery to bring to life such a swaggering sense of manliness, with or without whiskers, but especially with. Can't do it? Neither can I. But by sporting a mustache, I can bring a hint of that stag-like flavor to my own savory life. Later on, Sam Elliott took an awfully fine swing at that feeling with his incredibly aesthetic lip hedge in The Big Lebowski. Portraying the stranger in that film, a man with such life experience, including enough notches on his belt to be able to give advice to the dude for Pete's sake, required a brambly thicket of absolute chaparral beneath his nose, and Sam brought that shit. Hard. I also emulated a lot of sports figures in the 80s. We were really into sports in my house. Mike Ditka and Dick Butkus were the two most Rooseveltian members of the Chicago Bears organization, to my way of thinking. It was an amazing time to be loving sports teams around Chicago because the Cubs, of course, were great. They're always great. Shut up, reality! And the Bears had the best season in NFL history in 1985. Suck my balls, Miami 72. No question. Then Jordan's Bulls showed up. Phil Jackson. Mustache. I was at teen age, a very formative time for me to indulge in revering these superhero-looking guys with mustaches, like Walter Payton, Mike Singletary, all the Bears linebackers, Wilbur Marshall and Otis Wilson, plus William the Refrigerator Perry and Willie Gault. The Cubs were also great upper lip role models, with Ron Say, Billy Buckner, Dennis Eckersley, Fergie Jenkins, and Lee Smith all sporting cool-as-shit mustaches. Cy Young Award winner Raleigh Fingers of the Oakland A's must be included on any such list because he was a bewhiskered badass on the mound who brandished a full-on Snidely Whiplash handlebar mustache that was mighty intimidating to any poor sap facing him in the batter's box. Also, Goose Gossage, ladies and gentlemen. Earlier mustached film heroes, Errol Flynn, and really anybody playing Zorro, forever associated for me the gentlemanly pursuit of sword fighting with the mustache. Wyatt Earp brought his hirsute stash to the gunfight at the OK Corral, and was justifiably pissed that he was mainly remembered for only that one heroic day, when in truth, his whiskers saw him through careers as city policeman, county sheriff, teamster, buffalo hunter, bouncer, saloon keeper, gambler, brothel owner, pimp, miner, and boxing referee. Now that was a mustache. In the same vein, Mark Twain had the kind of lip bracken to land him on the list of men I've always idolized. His sense of humor always sounded to me like if someone real smart came from my neck of the woods, and he said what he meant. I shouldn't be surprised if, in my later years, I try to emulate his technique even more than I already do, writing stories about mischief while riding the nation's rivers astride a steamboat or a raft. In general, depending on your style, your mustache can read as heroic and lend a granite quality to your visage, or if you go in a slightly different direction, your mustache can connote criminality in a character. I think it's funny that when I'm playing a sheriff, I think, I'm gonna need a kick-ass mustache. But if I'm playing a bank robber, or cattle rustler, or Irish thug, I think, oh, I had better grow a kick-ass mustache. The important thing is to start with the mustache. Everything else can be adjusted around it, forcing your truth to trumpet beneath it, be that truth good or bad, strong or weak, sexy or abhorrent. On the heroic side, astronauts rock a mustache if they know what they're about. The straight dope is, if we're true to our natures, then we grow a robust beard. That is what was intended by the order of things. Society has put a spin on us, making a clean-shaven countenance the social norm, which, from Ma Nature's point of view, is bullshit. But then, so are air conditioning and saran wrap and Captain Crunch and a bunch of other cool shit that allows us to rise above nature at times. A mustache is a socialized way to say, okay, look, I'll let you see most of my face since that's what we're all doing right now, but if you would kindly direct your gaze to this thorn bush above my mouth, you will be reminded that I am a fucking animal and I'm ready to reproduce or rip your throat out if called upon because I come from nature. In this way, the mustache can be considered a relief valve of sorts, for the buildup of animal preening that most people completely repress. That's what makes a man with a good stash so cool, calm, and collected. It's funny to me that people ask me for tips on growing a mustache. I often reply, I honestly don't know. I was born with this mustache. I just cut it periodically so that it doesn't go down my throat when I'm enjoying my soup. My whiskers grow without any provocation from me whatsoever. I have about as much advice on growing a mustache as I do on growing fingernails or hemorrhoids. I'll tell you this much. My life is always more delicious when I have whiskers on my face, but that might just be because those whiskers tend to accumulate bacon crumbs and scotch, rendering them literally delicious all day long. In response to the query, how do you grow that robust mustache for Ron Swanson, I can walk you through the steps. Number 1, I don't shave my lip area. Number 2, after 2 weeks, I have a passable mustache in the form of long, luxurious stubble. Number 3, I continue to eschew the razor. Number 4, after 3 to 4 weeks, my whiskers have developed to the point where I can play a sheriff who is so tough that he eats nails, but still not Swanson. Number 5, I refuse to shave. Number 6, after 5 weeks, The whiskers growing from just beneath my nostrils have extended down, wire-like, to reach my top lip, a distance of 1 full imperial inch. Now, and only now, may I don the pleated dockers and thick long-sleeved knits of Pawnee's director of Parks and Recreation, with confidence and authority. Finally, I just want to add that I am a character actor, which means that, unlike good-looking actors, your Will Smiths and your Daniel Craigs, who always play, with great aplomb, different versions of the same dreamboat, I, lacking their cheekbones, rely on versatility